You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN's Daily Energy Blog, which is a fun and informative daily commentary on oil, gas, NGL, and renewable markets. Each morning, we cover commodity fundamentals and industry changes to keep you informed of developing trends across the energy landscape.
Thursday, March 5, 2026. Born to be Wild. U.S. Propane's Wild Journey from Lab Discovery to Vital Consumer Fuel. Published by Lisa Scheidler. Today, U.S. propane is a $75 billion-a-year business involving a maze of natural gas processing plants and salt caverns connected to pipelines, fractionators, rail facilities, truck racks, retail tanks, and export docks. But like many vital energy industries, the propane business began with a handful of scientists and entrepreneurs who experimented with something they didn't really understand. Over decades of development, propane has powered Olympic kitchens, lifted hot air balloons across the English Channel, and helped turn a quiet mound of southeastern Texas into the center of the global NGL universe. Along the way, propane attracted larger-than-life personalities and true born-to-be-wild characters who pushed the business forward in unique ways. In today's RBN blog, we'll discuss the history of U.S. propane. We've spent a lot of time discussing how the propane industry works today, who does what, how molecules move, and why it matters for prices and reliability. In part one of our recent series on the propane market, we walked through propane's journey from wellhead to burner tip and looked at the major demand segments, industrial, petrochemical, commercial, residential, and agricultural, and the roles that processing plants, refineries, wholesalers, and retailers play along the way. We showed how propane produced at fractionators and refineries often makes its first stop in vast underground salt cavern storage, then moves through a complex web of pipelines, rail cars, and transport trucks before reaching an end user. In part two, we detailed the role of wholesalers, the companies that sell propane to retailers by aggregating supplies, operating logistics networks, trading physical volumes, and other supply functions. In part 3, we outlined retailers' roles and functions in the market. For a more in-depth dive into the fascinating propane industry, check out our Propane Masterclass Encore, now available online. But none of this would be possible without the early discoveries of propane, dating back to the 1800s, when scientists, mostly chemists, were experimenting with a hydrocarbon gas they barely understood. Those experiments, and the messy trial and error that followed, laid the groundwork for the systems we might take for granted. Today, we'll highlight the discoveries and adventures that shaped propane's story and help explain why it plays the role it does in the world. From lab curiosity to household fuel, propane's story starts in 1857 with French chemist Marcelin Berthelot, who helped put modern organic chemistry on the map. He synthesized many compounds and propane was one of them, but he never figured out what to do with it. There was no way to liquefy or compress it yet, making it more of a lab curiosity than a viable energy solution. Fast forward to 1864, and English chemist Edmund Ronalds took the next step. He discovered propane was present in crude oil, along with other NGLs. He was better able to understand it and could even describe its properties and how it came from crude and gas, but he still didn't know exactly what to do with it. Not much else happened with propane until 1910, when Dr. Walter Snelling, a chemist and explosives expert really, with the U.S. Bureau of Mines, began studying a volatile wild gas that was propane. Snelling is now known as the father of propane. His real breakthrough was figuring out how to safely store and transport it. He developed a method for bottling a propane-butane mixture, which we now call liquefied petroleum gas, or LPG. According to the New York Times at the time, a single tank could light a home for 3 weeks. He continued refining the technology, and within a few years, propane became a viable commercial product sold by a company he backed, American Gasol. On May 17, 1912, Snelling received his first customer. It happened to be his father-in-law, John Goring, who installed the lighting and cooking system at his home in Waterford, Pennsylvania, about 30 minutes south of Lake Erie. That house has become famous in propane circles as the birthplace of the propane industry as a household fuel. Snelling excelled as a scientist, not so much as a businessman. American Gasol struggled to make money, and within a few years, the company was sold to someone who would dominate the propane business for decades, Frank Phillips, yes, that Phillips, the founder behind what eventually became Phillips 66 and ConocoPhillips. Phillips integrated propane marketing with his refineries and petroleum business, eventually branding the propane/LPG business as Philgas, the first large-scale propane brand. During the 1920s and 30s, he was a prime mover in the adoption of propane as a household fuel across rural America, helping to normalize its use. While Phillips was ramping up propane distribution, a major event helped establish propane's credibility: the 1932 Olympics in Los Angeles. That year, propane powered all the cooking appliances and heated the water in the Olympic Village, located about halfway between downtown and Santa Monica. This high-profile demonstration signaled that propane was ready for prime time. The next year produced an equally major development in the propane market, the adoption of an odorant for leak detection. On its own, propane is colorless, tasteless, and odorless. If it leaks, it can reach the point of combustion, meaning explosion, with no warning. In 1933, the industry started adding a trace amount of a sulfurous compound that smells like rotten eggs, that's ethyl mercaptan. The odorant burns without producing any smell. But if a leak occurs, you know it right away. That's why propane has a smell. Note, it's also the additive placed in natural gas for the same reason. Colorful characters and propane's modernization. Let's fast forward to 1947, where the next big turning point for propane occurs in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Bill Warren founded Warren Petroleum in the 1920s, a business focused on natural gasoline produced by casing head plants, the early forerunners of modern gas processing facilities. By the 1940s, Warren was all in on propane. On November 23, 1947, he made history with the launch of the Natalie Warren, a ship named after his wife. It was the first ocean-going tanker designed to carry propane and was built at Todd Shipyard's Houston facility. The ship's maiden voyage took it from the Houston Ship Channel all the way to Newark, New Jersey, a milestone in the evolution of the LPG business. We'll return to Warren in a minute. There have been many colorful characters among propane's founding fathers, but few were more over-the-top than Haynes Smokey Bilyeu. Smokey was the first person who made the idea of washing caverns out of salt work in practice. First, a bit about Smokey. In his prime, he was a big man and instantly recognizable. He favored a sombrero or cowboy hat over a long ponytail, loud shirts, overalls, and, often, a Colt .45 tucked into his belt. This was not your typical 1950s energy guy. In the early 1950s, Smokey and a few of his associates came up with the idea of storing LPG underground in caverns formed by dissolving salt deposits, with the first such cavern developed in West Texas. The concept caught on fast across the industry, but Smokey never got a patent and didn't receive a big licensing check. Still, this one has a happy ending. Over time, Smokey developed around 80 small salt caverns in the Conway MC Fersen area of Kansas, then eventually sold them for about $10 million, which was more than enough for him to ride off into the sunset quite comfortably. It was just a few years later that Bill Warren turned his attention to underground storage at Mont Belvieu, Texas. Warren is one of the key players who got Belvieu off the ground and made it the center of the NGL universe. He began developing underground storage caverns there in 1955 and ultimately built 26 caverns with a total capacity of about 23 million barrels. Today, the complex has expanded in scale, with more than 125 caverns and 300 million barrels of storage capacity. Warren also built the first fractionator at Mont Belvieu. Now, there are more than 30 fractionation units scattered across the hub. Unlike Smokey, Warren cashed out early and big. In 1953, he sold Warren Petroleum to Gulf Oil for $420 million. At the time, this was the largest midstream energy transaction ever completed. Gulf's assets ultimately flowed into Chevron, and then, over the decades, many of those legacy Warren assets ended up in the hands of Energy Transfer, which now operates a big chunk of what Warren started. Pipelines expand propane's reach. Another NGL and propane pioneer also emerged from Tulsa. Bob Thomas, who founded MAPCO, built the first dedicated propane/NGL pipeline in the U.S. in 1960. The system started in New Mexico, ran through Conway, Kansas, and delivered all the way to Minnesota and Wisconsin. In addition to propane, the system could batch other NGLs, including mixed NGLs bound for fractionators. In MAPCO's scheduling system, the product code for mixed NGL was called Y-grade, and that's where Y-grade got its name. Full disclosure, some propane moved on the TEPCO pipeline before 1960, but in very small volumes on a system mainly used for gasoline and diesel. Williams Companies Incorporated bought MAPCO in the 1990s, expanding its midstream footprint, but the merchant energy crisis and Enron's collapse in the early 2000s brought tough times. In 2002, Williams sold the system to Enterprise Products Partners, and that network continues to operate today as Enterprise's Mid-America Pipeline, or MAPLE, system. While our story of propane infrastructure traces its roots back only to the early 1960s, a great deal has unfolded since then, a topic worthy of another blog post on its own. Around that same period, propane was finding new frontiers beyond pipelines and storage caverns. In 1963, propane-fueled hot air balloons quite literally took flight. Ed Yost, often called the father of the modern hot air balloon, used his propane-burning design to cross the English Channel alongside fellow balloonist Don Picard. Today, Nearly every hot air balloon at festivals and tourist sites depends on propane burners for both lift and precise control. Propane looks a lot different than it did in the 1800s, but it's still part of the same origin story that curious individuals like Walter Snelling kicked off by taking a wild guess no one knew what to do with and turning it into a safe, storable energy product. Back then, the challenges were figuring out how to liquefy it, bottle it, and move it. Today, it's the same basic physics, but scaled up to salt caverns, pipelines, fractionators, and export docks. While it is a massively global business, many U.S. families still count on small entrepreneurs to deliver propane to their homes for heating and cooking. That part is very much the same. One last note for anyone eager to learn more about the history of propane and NGLs. There's a book called The Energy Merchant by Rufus Jarman, published in 1977, focused on Bob Thomas and the MAPCO story. You can still find used copies, and if you're wonky enough about energy market history, it's worth picking up. Born to Be Wild was written by Mars Bonfire and appears as the fifth song on Steppenwolf's eponymous debut album. A point of interest is Mars Bonfire is the brother of Steppenwolf drummer Jerry Edmonton. Both brothers were in the original version of Steppenwolf when they were in Canada and called The Sparrow. Bruce Palmer, later of Buffalo Springfield, was also in this version. Bonfire and Edmonton's original surnames were McCrohan. The song has the first usage of the term heavy metal in its lyrics. Ironically, Bonfire initially wrote the song as a ballad. After it was featured, along with The Pusher, in the 1969 film Easy Rider, with Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda riding Harleys from Los Angeles to New Orleans, it became the anthem of motorcycle organizations around the world. The first biker anthem was actually released in July 1966. Blues Theme, from the film Wild Angels, was a fuzzed-out guitar instrumental featuring Davy Allen and the Arrows. The stars of the film were Peter Fonda and Nancy Sinatra. Born to Be Wild was released as a single in June 1968 and went to number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 Singles chart and has been certified gold by the Recording Industry Association of America, RIAA. Personnel on the record were John Kay, vocals, rhythm guitar, Michael Monarch, lead guitar, Goldie McJohn, organ, Rushton Moore of bass, and Jerry Edmonton, drums. The album, Steppenwolf, was recorded in the fall of 1967 at American Recording in Studio City, California, and produced by Gabriel Meckler. It was Meckler who suggested the name Steppenwolf to the band, after recently reading the novel by Hermann Hesse. The album cover would feature a Henry Diltz photo of the band, presented in silver foil. Released in January 1968, the album went to number 6 on the Billboard 200 albums chart and has been certified gold by the RIAA. Three singles were released from the LP. Steppenwolf was a Canadian-American rock band formed in Los Angeles in 1967. John Kay, Goldie McJohn, and Jerry Edmonton were in the Canadian band, The Sparrow, and recruited Los Angeles musicians Monarch and Morev after relocating to Hollywood. Rehearsing in a garage on Fountain Avenue in West Hollywood, the band soon made a name for themselves playing clubs and signed with Dunhill Records in the fall of 1967. They released 13 studio albums, 5 live albums, 9 compilation albums, and 21 singles. Over 36 members passed through the band since its formation, with John Kay being the only original member in many iterations of the group. Kay announced he retired the name Steppenwolf in October 2018. Rushton Moreev died in Los Angeles in July 1981 at 32. Jerry Edmonton died in Santa Barbara, California, in November 1993 at 47. Goldie McJohn died in Berlin, Washington, in August 2017 at 72. Michael Monarch lives in Hollywood and was the guitarist for Detective. He occasionally plays shows. John Kay lives in Nashville and still performs occasionally.
Thanks for listening to the RBN Daily Energy Blogcast. For more information on energy market reports, maps, and consulting engagements, please visit us at rbnenergy.com. And thanks for rocking with us.